This podcast is made possible by the generosity of supporting members. Please visit dharmaocean.org to learn more about becoming a supporting member. You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. In today's episode, Reggie discusses the different stages of the meditative journey. He says that stages do not mean accomplishment. Rather, they simply reflect how our experience of the totality deepens as the journey of meditation unfolds. This talk was given at the 2014 Mahamudra for the Modern World Retreat, held at the Blazing Mountain Retreat Center in Crestone, Colorado.
When I started practicing Mahamudra a long time ago, probably 30 or 35 years ago, I viewed Mahamudra as over here. Over here is me and my life, my so-called life. My shitty life, my hope and fear life, my neurotic life, my basically no future life, you know, whatever your thing is. So that's here. And Mahamudra is this glorious thing over here. And if I can just, you know, get from here to there, I'm going to be in good shape. And so I use the practices, and I think we all do this, as a way to exit from our actual situation into something that's a lot more pleasant, a lot more spacious, a lot more open, and has a lot less stress, a lot less anxiety. And the fact is, we can actually do that. We can do it. We can use practices to exit from our actual situation and do something else. I mean, that's why a lot of us were so attracted to Tibet. You know, one of the best things about Tibet in the 70s was, it's not America. And Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, I mean, the man, you hear stories, but he's a very gentle, actually, individual, most of the time. There were some notable exceptions in my life and everybody else's. But he was saying, you know, that's not really what we're doing here. We're not really running away. We're not really trying to get into some other state. And he called this approach, getting into this other state, spiritual materialism, which is basically creating another kind of ego, another kind of self-image that's more pleasant than the one that we currently have. That's very disembodied. In fact, it's dissociated. It's dissociated. Because we've separated actually from our human existence. His encouragement in his teaching, but much more so in his personal interactions with all of us, which he compared to the crocodile. You know, the crocodile's teeth face in. So once the crocodile clamps down, the more you struggle, the more you're trapped. That was his approach. Rinpoche, I love you. Please teach me. Well, you know the journey's hard. No, I'm into it. Better to finish than... And if you can't finish, don't start. No, Rinpoche, this is really what I want. And then it was, your life is the ground of the journey. You have to relate to your own life. And your, if we want to talk about realization, it's going to be found within the claustrophobic prison of your current existence. It's not going to be found outside. And that's actually the view of Mahamudra. The minute you separate and you try to go outside, there's a tension set up. I'm sure you know this, those of you who have practiced, you know, tried to do this practice in a disembodied way. The tension is that you're trying to move away from the claustrophobia of this into the freedom of that. And it takes a lot of energy actually to maintain that separation, and a lot of energy to sort of push away and dismiss the sort of rugged, neurotic qualities of our own state of mind, our dysfunctional relationships, and so on. To separate from those and not to be swallowed up by anxiety takes a lot of energy. And you can get out there and you can experience moments of peace, but they don't last, as I think we all know, and they don't fundamentally change us. They may give us a technique that's useful in certain situations. But the Mahamudra tradition really, and again, as I think Carolyn was saying this morning, it's about a fundamental human transformation. It's about a transformation of our actual body, of our actual neurological wiring. It's a change in the way in which we experience life. It's fundamental. It can be viewed as physical, it can be viewed as neurological, it can be viewed as emotional, it can be viewed as intellectual, it can be viewed as spiritual. It's a change that actually permeates everything that we are. We truly do become a different person, and we operate in a different way. And that's only going to be possible if we take seriously our own life at this moment, and we're willing to engage it and explore it. In the tradition, we talk about ground, path, and fruition, Mahamudra, which I know you know you've been exposed to that already. The ground Mahamudra is the river of life. And the thing about the river of life is we are the river of life. There's nothing in us that is outside of that river. There's nothing in us that's dead. There isn't one cell in our body that's dead. There isn't one emotion. There isn't one thought that's dead. Everything is alive, and everything is the universe expressing its perfection in our own state of being, our own life, our own experience. And on some level, know that, and we feel it. But we are, we live in a culture, and we live in a highly differentiated social environment, which has required the formation of an identity. And we can say the identity is not real. We can say the ego image we have of ourselves isn't fundamentally reflect who we are. And that's true, but it has a function. It enables us to be in society as a certain person with a certain place and a certain role. But what happens is we start to believe in it. We start to believe in this small self. And we're human, we're vulnerable. You know, we're afraid all the time. We're afraid of everything. We're afraid of being hurt. We're afraid of being rejected. We're afraid of getting sick. We're afraid we won't be able to survive, we won't be able to make a living. We're afraid we're going to die. And all these are legitimate. This is our situation as humans. We are so vulnerable. And no one else really cares about us. We have friends, we have family, but nobody else really cares. I mean, if we drop dead, nobody's really going to care, actually. Nobody cares, really. And nobody really actually likes anybody either. We have all this, you know, politics we do with each other, but basically we're so alone in this world, each of us. So this desire to have something we can hang on to is very deep and it's very legitimate. And what we try to hang on to is an image of myself, who I am, what reality is, who you are. And we retract from the vastness of our own life, from the vastness of our experience. and we kind of shrivel up into a very small version. And the problem with that is we've lost touch with the source. Not in some kind of, you know, metaphysical sense, but in the sense of the source of every moment of our life is this river. You know, we lose touch with the fact that we are part of the universe's expression, each moment by moment by moment. The beauty of the universe as it shows itself in us. The magic of the universe, the wonder of the universe, the wonder of being is expressed in each one of us moment by moment, and we lose touch with that. And we become obsessed with trying to be okay. And we do feel that lack. We feel a longing for the totality. And the reason we feel that longing is because that's really who we are and who we've always been. So we enter the spiritual path. Grand Mahamudra is the river of life, and the spiritual path is acknowledging our disconnection, our dissociation from the ground of ourself and of our life, and trying to find the way back. Sometimes the Mahamudra tradition is presented as a kind of freestanding body of teaching, like you just come and do Mahamudra, and you're given this, you know, relatively advanced set of teachings without the necessary preparation. And I understand why that happens, you know, because in our culture, if the only people you ever taught were people who actually laid the groundwork step by step so that when you get to Wangchuk Dorje's type of teachings, you're ready for it, nobody would come. Nobody would stick it out. So I understand why it's done. But it's not really that helpful, because if you practice, try to follow the path back to the source without laying the groundwork, you don't have the, if I can use a neuroscience for a minute, you don't have the neurobiological capacity to actually do the practice. What happened in the tradition in India and Tibet and China and Japan, because Mahamudra was practiced in all these traditions, even though in different, all these cultures, although they were called different things, is that you went through this process, which Caroline referred to this morning. There's a way of going, of being trained in the Mahamudra tradition, where you build step by step so that when you get to the fifth jhana, which we'll talk about, you know, briefly in a minute, when you get there, you can actually show up. Otherwise, what you're doing is you're kind of imitating Mahamudra, but at a very crude level. And I understand why it's true in this culture. You know, I understand why we're given things that we're not ready for, and I endorse it. You know, I think it's very important for these teachings to be spread around. At the same time, you know, it's my responsibility to speak to what we need to do in order to actually attain genuine, actual realization in the tradition. And that's, in a sense, you know, I think my teaching mission right now. What do we actually have to do? In this program, I just want to kind of lay it out for you. And most of you will be familiar with the territory, but you may not be familiar with this way of looking at it. So number one is we have to come back to our incarnation, because that's actually where it begins and where it ends, our human incarnation. Thinking of our human incarnation as some small and paltry thing is such a misunderstanding. The universe expresses itself in a lot of different states of being, all the way from the components of a proton. So we're not even talking atoms, we're talking about subatomic particles. The universe expresses itself there. There was a time when they didn't exist, when there was absolute emptiness at the beginning of the universe. And out of that absolute quantum emptiness came what's known as the Big Bang, this huge energy born out of emptiness. And out of that energy came protons, neutrons, and so on. The universe expresses itself there. It expresses itself in, you know, the formation of stars and planets, the birth of life, formation of galaxies and trees and rocks in us. And everything has its own state of being, And everything, many people feel, and I feel no doubt about it whatsoever, everything has its own style of awareness and its own journey. Everything is on a journey, and we're no exception. And our human incarnation is one instance of the absolute perfection and sacredness of the universe. We happen to be custodians. We happen to be located. We have our awareness has showed up in this incarnation. And this incarnation is everything. Everything in the universe is included in us in the same way that it's included in a galaxy or a molecule or the universe itself. That's a teaching from the Avatamsaka Sutra. Everything is here in our incarnation. And the more seriously we take it, the more we can make a journey to understand not just our own life, but the life of everything. In fact, being itself is available to us, but it's only available in one place, which is our unique human life. Our unique human life is incarnated in our body. It's not in our thinking mind. It's not in our left brain. It's in the awareness and the intelligence of our body. To go back to neurobiology just for a minute, because I'll be using these terms, we have our left brain, which is called second-order processing, meaning that our left brain thinks about, analyzes, categorizes, judges, and strategizes in relation to our direct experience of life. Our direct experience of life happens in what used to be called the right brain, but now they're talking about subcortical. In other words, everything below the executive functions of the ego, everything that is direct experience, which means the brainstem, limbic system, deeper parts of the limbic system, the heart. The knowledge of the heart is objective, has nothing to do with ego. The knowledge of the gut. And frankly, every cell in our body is filled with awareness. It's aware. It's hard to imagine knowledge that happens only in your toe, but it happens to be a fact. The more we're up in our head, the more we're separate from our own incarnation. The more we inhabit our body with awareness, fully and totally, the more we are present to this life of ours, to our entire karmic situation, and to everything that we are and everything that we're involved in and our place in life. So that's the first step. We have to come into presence to ourself. And in our culture, as you know, that's a receding horizon right now. And especially with the acceleration of digital ways of communication with one another. And even, I'm sure you've heard of virtual life. Do you know what that is? Where we have one student whose spouse spends his entire life on his computer having virtual relationships with other people. And the big problem is he won't relate to his actual family. And, I mean, I mention this because this is what's happening now. So in our culture, we're in a state of more and more and more and more and more disembodiment from the richness and the fullness and the presence, not only to ourselves, but to each other. So that's step number one, called the ground jhana. And in this program, every teaching session I do with you, we're going to begin with the ground, we're going to be working with the body, because if we're not here, it's not worth it. There's no point. We're not doing anything valuable. And then the second one, and again I'm going over it again, but I want to be able to refer to these, is the second jhana, which we call Hinayana for now. We'll have to come up with a different name because a lot of people don't like that name. I don't really like it either. But it refers to learning how to stay present with this incarnation. Because it's one thing to be able to show up in your incarnation, but we're very impulsive people. And when anything painful comes up, anything uncomfortable, we're out of here. There was a guy who came, I was really looking forward to meeting him, he already left. What? He left. He left the program. But the program hasn't really started yet. But he said just, you know, it just came to him that he had to leave. But the thing is, that's what we do all the time. We are constantly leaving because it's too uncomfortable, it's too unpleasant. We don't know how to stay. We don't know how to be present through the ups and downs of life. So we can learn how to be, to show up in our body. That's number one, ground jnana. Number two is, but how do we actually stay with it? Because that's where the gates are to realization. So we have to stay with number two. And we learn through the Shikantaza to feel what it's like to actually be present to our incarnation, and it's almost impossible. It's almost impossible. In fact, it is impossible. You sit there and, you know, you're told, well, it's really very simple. All you have to do is just be present to your body for 45 minutes. 45 minutes! Could we try 45 seconds? Or could we try 0.45 seconds? Being present to our incarnation teaches us how to be present, period. And so there's a lot of work we do with impulse and dismantling impulse in the second jnana. And then we sort of get like, okay, this is working for me. I can hang out. I can hang out in my body. I'm getting there, I can stay with it. And then the Mahayana is, that's good, but there's so much more subtlety in your body than you may have seen. And that's where the work with the heart comes in. We have to work with our heart and open it, again, through somatic practices, not through thinking about it or imagining things, but breathing into the heart and opening our heart. We begin to discover there's a level of feeling in us that is so refined and so subtle and so intensely sensitive, and we begin to pick up what's going on in our environment. We begin to feel, actually, what other people are feeling. We can sit with someone and they can talk to us, but we actually know how they're feeling because we can tap in. We know. This is not some kind of esoteric practice. It's a natural capacity of the heart that is just at this point in this culture completely shut down for most of us. Now you might say, well, why can't I do that right off? Because what comes up when we start working at this level of subtlety is not only the very deep love and feeling of connection that we have with others, but we also begin to experience our own trigger points. The more open we are, the more sensitive we are, the more we begin to see and to feel how we are set off by so many things, and our earliest traumas are activated. And we all do it. If you become a meditation instructor in this lineage, you're going to have to work with your own traumas, your own pre-verbal horrifying experiences which cause you to shut down in a certain particular kind of way. For me, you know, when I get that, when that part of me is chafed, I suddenly feel the way I did when I was 1 year old in my crib and my mother would not come because she'd read some book by Dr. Spock and may he rot in hell that said that you should let children cry because it's good for them and don't feed them. You know, let them cry for a few hours. Well, a few hours for, you know, an infant is an eternity. So that's my thing. You know, I go back into that not only does nobody love me, not only is the world a horrible, cold, hopeless place, but there's a level of despair, which, you know, in a way I'm glad, you know, that I went through this because I know how it is with babies. I know how it can be a place of absolute and utter hopelessness and despair where there's no help and there's never going to be any help ever. And as my age now, I can go into that state of mind. If the circumstances are right, you know, and the situation is a certain way, that state of mind comes up. And that state of mind is in each of us, you know, some equivalent state of mind. And unfortunately, until we start to deal with it, it controls the way we see the world. When we get to the Mahayana, we're talking about working not just on our immediate embodiment, but we're talking about our relationality, our attachment disorders, if you want to put it that way. And we're starting to see, you know, I can't really love this person because I have this whole skewed way that I view everybody, actually, in the world. And that blockage is sitting there in all of us until we actually deal with it. So at the Mahayana level, that's largely the work that we begin to do. There is a term, and you know, again, I don't want to put too much Buddhism into this because it's really not necessary. But Buddhism talks about what we could say a surface disorder, which is like, I'm really angry, I'm really paranoid, I'm really upset. That's a conscious kind of neurotic upheaval. That's called the first veil. But then there's this other thing that's deeper, and it's actually more important, called the second veil, and that's what I'm talking about now. That based on our early experiences, we have certain assumptions about what reality is and what other people are and who we are and how it fits that are not conscious. They're not available at this present moment to be worked with. And they control everything we see and everything we do. Talking about the experience of Mahamudra is pointless at the upper level until we deal with that level. Because the way they talk about it is, it's called, the veil in Sanskrit is called klesha, or called janeya avarana. What that means is, there's a veil between you and what you have to know. There's something to be known. There's something to be experienced. And this gets between you and what there is to be experienced. And guess what there is to be experienced? The river of life. The sacredness of your state of being. Fruition Mahamudra. So in the Mahayana, through working with the heart in a lot of different ways, we begin to identify that. And then the Vajrayana, there are a lot more tools given for that one thing, to remove this veil between ourselves and what there is to be known. At the end of the Vajrayana, then, is the fifth yana. And can I tell you a little bit about the fifth yana? Are you totally burned out? Well, I'll do it anyway. When we arrive at the pinnacle, and the reason we need to talk about it is we need to feel the deep longing that we have toward it. Fruition Mahamudra is the ground Mahamudra, but we're living it, we're in touch with it. It's us. There are eight illuminations, and I'm just going to mention them, and then we'll talk about them. We'll actually practice them later. So the first thing is that the nature of the river of life, the nature of reality as it is, and we're talking now about this reality, we're not talking about something somewhere else, it's completely and totally open. Completely and totally open. There's no impediment. There's nothing ever hidden. It's totally disclosed to us. We are never separate from it, even in our darkest days. Number two is, there's no boundary on our body at all. The body has no boundary, actually. If you've ever read Jill Bolte Taylor's book, My Stroke of Insight, she talks about what it's like to lose your left brain. And one of the things she said is she realized that her body and the universe were not separate. Well, that's actually the nature of our deepest experience. We're not separate from the universe. In fact, the universe, our body is the universe. This idea that we have this, you know, limited physical form is actually an ego imposition. The minute you take your left brain and you take it offline, your experience of your own body is boundless. Number three is called perfection, natural great perfection, which is the nature of life itself is perfect. And that perfection, these are all experiential, you know, these are not theories. They're what we come upon, you know, when we dismantle the barriers between ourself and our own fundamental human experience, we realize that everything that happens is part of a huge, fantastic, colorful, sacred display and dance of the universe. And we are part of the dance as much as anything else, even as much as galaxies or nebulas or black holes or whatever it may be. Number four is absolute uniqueness, which means that as immeasurable as the universe is in all of its extent, you know, it's trillions and trillions of stars and trillions and trillions and trillions of planets that no doubt have billions and billions and billions of forms of life, and each one of those forms of life has its own experience, that every moment of every being is unique. Every moment of our life, everything that ever happens is unique. And the only reason we don't see it is because of these veils. And then number five, strangely enough, that the experience, fundamental river of life and everything that happens to us is completely personal. It's as if we are the only being in the universe, and each moment of our life is the whole universe singing to us and freeing us and loving us. It's absolutely personal. Then number six is, we experience, and of course as humans it sounds like hubris, but the experience of the human person is that he or she is at the center of the universe. And if you know much about astrophysics, you will know that at this point, that's actually a literal cosmological fact, that each one of us dwells in our person where the universe began. And I'm just going to say it in two sentences, I mean, otherwise we'd have to go on forever. But when the Big Bang occurred and the energy apparently started moving out, that isn't what happened. The legitimation of this is Einstein's general and special theories of relativity and the thought that's gone around afterwards. But that's not what happened. It's not like there's a bang and then the energy started going out and then everything started going out and everything go out and there's this center. What happened was nothing moved, but space began to grow between everything. Space grew. Nothing moved. So what that means is that we and every atom in our body is still at the very center of the universe. And this turns up experientially in that feeling that we have, that we are at the center of being. And this is something, you know, because we're so scared of our ego, we're so scared of egomania, that, you know, we really don't want to go there. But the fact is, the more your ego falls away, the more you feel at the center. The more you feel at the very center of being. So that's number six. Number seven is you begin to realize that your, as I said before, your incarnation is what Caroline, I think, referred to as absolutely concrete existence. Is that what you said this morning? That what we actually are is the full revelation of the universe, full, with nothing left over. And the more we come into our body, the more we come into our direct way of knowing, which is the body's way of knowing, the more we see our left thinking mind as an assistant rather than as the conductor, the more we understand the importance of our incarnation and its sacredness, but more importantly, the more we can commit ourselves completely to being in the world as this person in this place with this karmic situation and this historical period, completely and totally commit ourselves to it. And there's no ego involved whatsoever. And then the last one is called the return, and that is the understanding that death actually is life. There actually is no death. there's no such thing as death. There's no such thing as non-existence. That's the end of existence. Death is the womb. It's the darkness that gives birth to life. Now, it's one thing to say it, but it's another thing to know it and to live in such a way that whether you live or whether you die, you feel the power and the beauty of life flowing through you. These eight illuminations define a way of being. And it's something in a way we all know on some level, intuitive level. We've always known it. And that's the ground. And then the path is that we don't want to let this human life pass without making ourselves transparent to that way of being, becoming that person, becoming that infinite reality that is calling to us all the time.
Download more of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.